So he was musing out loud at one of these gatherings where world, you know, central bank presidents from Poland and Argentina and ex-finance ministers tend to gather. This is in Washington, D.C., in January of 1993. He said, "One will have to ask whether it could conceivably make sense to think of deliberately provoking a crisis so as to remove the political logjam to reform. For example, it has sometimes been suggested in Brazil that it would be worthwhile stoking up a hyperinflation so as to scare anyone into accepting those changes. Presumably, no one with historical foresight would have advocated in the mid-1930s that Germany or Japan go to war in order to get the benefits of the supergrowth that followed their defeat. But could a lesser crisis have served the same function? Is it possible to conceive of a pseudo-crisis that could serve the same positive function without the cost of a real crisis?" Now, that was the month that Canada hit the debt wall. 1993, covers of the Globe and Mail, specials on CTV, we were about to go broke, if you will recall. Now, Linda McQuaig, the wonderful investigative journalist and great supporter of the CCPA, in her book, Shooting the Hippo, she goes into, and I'm sure many of you have read it, but it's interesting to think about in this context. She tells this extraordinary story about going to, talking about how the think tanks in Canada, particularly the C.D. Howe Institute and the BCNI, were using the threat that Canada's credit rating was going to be downgraded and nobody would want to invest in our country because we were going to hit the debt wall. So even though things seemed fine, under the surface, apocalypse awaited. And the only way out was for us to cut our social programs. Linda went to New York, and she went to Standard & Poor's. And she met with the guy whose job it was to... she went to Moody's. And she met with the guy whose job it was to issue Canada's credit rating. And he told her this absolutely extraordinary story about how heavily he was getting lobbied by Bay Street to downgrade Canada's credit rating. He thought Canada's economy was doing great, and he kept issuing these AAA credit ratings, and he kept getting phone calls of bankers screaming in his ear, and he said he'd never experienced anything like this because usually countries would call and ask to have a higher credit rating and scream at him because they'd given them a B, but Canada, he said, Canadians usually, if anything, disparage their country far more than foreigners do. Now, that isn't just, oh, you know, we Canadians, we're always insulting ourselves. It's not that. It's that the business community in this country knew that they needed a pseudo-crisis. They created it, which is really the function of these think tanks, not just intellectual disaster preparedness, but creating the crisis to themselves, not waiting for them to happen, creating them, and then taking advantage of them. And of course, we know what happened in the 1995 budget in this country. Here's the bad news. These tactics work, obviously. Why do they work? For the same reason it works to pick someone's pocket at a car accident. We can't defend ourselves in moments of crisis. This is the lowest of the low. When we are disoriented, that's precisely why crises are so appealing. People are pushed out of the way. Democracy is messy. It's easy to remake New Orleans school systems when the people are gone. These tactics work. That's the bad news. Here's the scary news. They're not working as well as they used to, so the disasters that they're taking advantage of are getting bigger. That's what we see with this transition from taking advantage of debt crises, currency shocks, to taking advantage of massive environmental disasters and wars. But the good news is that shock is a temporary state. By its very nature, what shock is the moment that we go into when information comes in that we can no longer process. We go into a kind of freeze frame, right? We go into a sort of suspended animation. We don't have enough information to process what's happening. We are off guard. We're scrambled. But we get oriented. Shock can't last. By its very nature, it's a temporary state, and shock wears off. And shock is wearing off. This movement, this counter-revolution began in Latin America 35 years ago. And I believe that that's why we are seeing the most radical resistance and real alternatives to neoliberalism coming out of Latin America, not because Latin Americans are inherently more radical than the rest of the world. They've had more time to come out of shock. They never won the battle of ideas. That's the great myth, that's the great fairy tale. All they did was kick us when we were down. They didn't win the intellectual debate. That means that we never stopped believing that we could build a more just, egalitarian society. We never stopped believing it. So all these ideas that were blasted out of the way by crisis, by disasters, by tanks, by torture, were just under the surface, and they're bubbling up again. They're bubbling back up again. It's happening in Latin America. You see it in Bolivia. You see it in Venezuela. You see it in Chile, where all of this began, where there were just huge student strikes, a new generation of young people who aren't afraid and are demanding a universal education system and are rebelling against the charter school system that they were the laboratory rats for. They want a more just system. China, this labor market that was created in terror so profitably. There were 26,000 labor strikes and protests in China last year. Why? Because shock wears off. It is a temporary state. It's easy to be discouraged by how much more funding the right-wing think tanks have. You know, Seth said the Fraser Institute, they've got $6 million. Well, here's the thing. They need that money. They need that money, and they need Can West, and they need CTV, and they need Belt. They need it because they have a really tough intellectual job. Their job, well, I'll quote Milton Friedman in a letter to Augusto Pinochet in 1975. He said, "The major error, in my opinion, is to believe it's possible to do good with other people's money." Their job is to convince people that by trying to do good, you do bad. And by doing bad, by pursuing your most selfish desires, you do good. Crazy, crazy talk. Very expensive to convince people of something so deeply counterintuitive. It is much cheaper, to convince people that to do good, bad, bad. Because we know this. We already know. You know, it's interesting, when I was preparing for this speech, I was sort of thinking a lot about think tanks, and the CCPA is not a think tank. Some people say it's a left-wing think tank. It's not. It's a public policy research institute. It's longer, but it's important. It's an important distinction. Why? Because tanks are for creatures in captivity. They swim in circles. The food is free. The water is foul. So let the Friedmanites have their billion-dollar think tanks. I'd rather be with the CCPA, roaming wild and free on the untamed intellectual plains. Can you see it? You, me, the CCPA, and all of those rebellious, renationalized Mongolian yaks. Thank you.